This week on Art of the Air, our whole show features Kirsten and Brandon Dickerson, with Kirsten, founder of ArtistAndNomad.com, that coaches female changemakers across the world, and Brandon, an award-winning filmmaker and educator, discussing their new film, Handmade Future. Our spotlights on the Lakeshore Public Media's viewing and discussion of the Ken Burns film, The American Revolution, on June 23rd at the Lake County Library.
Express yourself through art, and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art, and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther, Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art, and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art, and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight from Lakeshore Public Media, talking about the second screen and discussion of America's 250th anniversary. We have Michelle Hassinger, and she is actually a board member there, but also is heading up the second event. And our guest today, that's evening, Dr. Ellen Charletta, and they'll be talking about, first of all, a little bit about the details of the event, and she's one of the panelists with us. Welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, very nice meeting both of you.
Well, Michelle, we'll start with you to talk about this event, maybe how it differs from the Valpo event, and, you know, just the information background and how you're approaching this one.
Absolutely. We are really excited to have Lakeshore Public Media hosting its second community event, screening the PBS documentary, The American Revolution. The Lake County screening is going to be on Thursday, June 23rd, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Merrillville branch of the Lake County Public Library. This program is part of a nationwide commemoration marking the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The Lake County screening is going to focus on the spirit of service, and attendees will be viewing excerpts from the 12-part PBS documentary, The American Revolution, which is directed by acclaimed filmmaker Ken Burns, along with Sarah Bolstein and David Schmidt. Our screening is going to be followed by a panel discussion exploring service and civic engagement as a core American value. And we are really excited to have excellent representation across the region serving as the discussion panel for this event. Those attendees include Eddie Melton, the mayor of Gary, Kelly Anno, the president and CEO of Legacy Foundation, representing nonprofit, Mike Tolbert, founding partner at Tolbert & Tolbert, and also a former president of the Indiana State Bar Association, Paul Rodriguez, vice president of People's Bank, Isaiah Harvey, a youth innovator, junior at Merrillville High School and founder of Quantum Visionary Foundation, and of course, Not least of all, Dr. Ellen Charletta, the director of Indiana University Northwest Center for Urban and Regional Excellence. I'm going to introduce or hand it over to Ellen here to just talk a little bit about some of her background and how it relates to our theme of the spirit of service and civic engagement.
Good afternoon, Michelle, and thank you. And I am very happy to be here this afternoon. Briefly, as Michelle said, I'm the director of the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence. And one of our responsibilities is to connect the university's knowledge and experience with that of the community. One of the ways that we have done this is to work with the Indiana Bar Foundation and a number of other organizations across the state to produce what's called the Indiana Civic Health Index. The first one was put out in 2011, and our last one was put out just recently in January of 2026. It's our 2025 edition with a few in between, five, six. I think I lost count, Larry. So it's if you want to think about it as the state's report card on civic health, I think that's a really good way for us to connect to what the value is of the Civic Health Index. And so I'm one of the authors there, been lead author in the past, and I'm really excited to be part of this panel.
Will there be hard information on that? Are there some housing and placemaking things in development now? I mean, actually happening?
Yeah. So, the Civic Health Index has two main components to it. One is the report card, how we're doing on different categories of civic engagement. People may not really recognize how many different forms there are for us to get engaged in our communities. And so that data does talk about differences between rural, urban, and then we have recommendations. Those recommendations have primarily been in the area of civic education, recognizing that improving civic health starts with our youth and their understanding of democracy. So we have not produced anything in the way of housing recommendations or anything like that. If I can briefly tell you about the categories, we're talking about a category, of course, voting and voter registration is one way that we are actually measuring civic engagement. Another would be volunteering. So this would be a more informal structure that we use to express our civic connections. We also look at how people interact with institutions. Originally, when it first started with newspapers, with radio, now we look at social media and other forms of institutions there. And then, of course, we also look at individual interactions with local government primarily. So things like participating with our local officials. So those are the main areas of civic engagement this particular report takes a look at. And so I hope to share some of those details because there's lots of details. We've got some real strengths. We also have some areas that we have to work on. And I think our other panelists will be talking about how this then connects. And I'll talk a little bit how it connects to the Ken Burns American Revolution, because essentially we started as a nation of service. And so we're going to take a look 250 years later and see how we're doing here in the state of Indiana.
In our final moments, Michelle, why don't you tell us the details again about how people can come see the event at the Lake County Library?
Absolutely. Alan, we are super excited to have you. Again, that will be on Thursday, June 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Merrillville branch of the Lake County Public Library. You can go to the Lakeshore Public Media website to register to attend the event. No cost to register, but please do go and register in advance. And Ellen and our other panelists, as well as the 30-minute screening, we are really excited to talk about civic engagement and the spirit of service and really motivate the region to volunteer.
Well, we'd like to thank you for coming on to the Air Spotlight, Michelle Hassinger, and of course, Dr. Ellen Charlotta. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing. The event again is June 23rd, and you can find out information at lakeshorepublicmedia.org website and click on the graphic. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Michelle.
Thank you so much.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting. With end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation, Ember Forge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. We are delighted to invite you to attend a screening of the new Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, David Schmidt PBS documentary, The American Revolution, in celebration of the 250th anniversary of the United States. Lakeshore Public Media, along with Indiana Humanities, are hosting a viewing and discussion at Merrillville's Lake County Library on June 23rd at 6 p.m. The moderated panel of local community leaders will celebrate the spirit of service, examining volunteerism, civic participation, and public leadership. To make your reservations, go to Lakeshore Public Media website and click on the event graphic.
This is Manoush Zomorodi, host of NPR's TED Radio Hour, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Kirsten and Brandon Dickerson to Art on the Air. They are the founders of Artist and Nomad, an impact business focused on regenerative practices. They have decades of experience in both film and social impact initiatives involving artisans and people living on the margins of our global community. Handmade Future is their documentary film that explores the ethics, artistry, and equity of the global artisan sector, showcasing the beauty and importance of heritage crafts, the challenges faced by makers worldwide, and the inspiring people keeping artisan crafts alive. Kirsten brings a wealth of experience to her directorial debut film, Handmade Future. She was CEO of an ethical fashion company, Raven & Lily, to president of a global women's empowerment nonprofit, and with her husband, they founded Artist and Nomad, a regenerative travel, design, and film company. She has garnered numerous awards for her work. Brandon is an award-winning writer, director, producer with more than 25 years of experience in independent film, commercials, and music videos. After teaching filmmaking at London Screen Academy, he will join Baylor University Film and Digital Media faculty as an assistant professor in the fall of 2026. Thank you both for joining us on Art on the Air. I also want to extend a huge thank you to Marla Schofer of The Winding Road for the introduction. Aloha and welcome, Kirsten and Brandon. It's so wonderful meeting you.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Hello. Wonderful to be here.
Well, we'd like to start off our show by getting the background of our guests, though Esther kind of gave a lot of it. But we wanted you to tell your own story, and we'll start with Kirsten. Tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now, at least up to the point where you guys got together.
Great. Well, I grew up in Texas, outside of Houston, actually in a very suburban, white, upper middle class community. So I wasn't exposed to a lot of diversity or difference or suffering or anything like that. And then I went to Baylor University in the 90s. And so I kind of had a typical suburban American life in that way up to that point. And when I was in Baylor, I met still some of my best friends in the world. That's actually where I met Brandon, but we'll get to that in a second. But and they really became like friends I'd never had before. And I still get together with this group of friends from Baylor every year. They get together. And when I'm available and in the country, I try to get together with them. But that's been over 30 years of meeting together. And that's how close this group of women is. So there's like incredible people that go there. But again, it was kind of like a bubble in the 90s. And so there were opportunities that came my way that became very transforming in who I am today. One was I was mentored by a couple that ran one of the local outreaches that worked with the homeless and a lot of the single moms in the community and kids that were really struggling. And I just started showing up and volunteering with them and learning from them. And it really opened my eyes to seeing more of the stories behind people that I often saw begging on the sides of the streets or communities that you often bypassed in Waco, Texas, where we were. And so it made me want to be in those communities and learn from this couple. And so they had a big impact on my life. And they're with an organization called Mission Waco that's still active today. And it really opened up my heart to the poor and in ways that I could engage in being a friend and advocate for people that were on the margins, especially women. And then at Baylor, they had a Baylor in Africa program when I was there. And I really felt drawn to seeing the world outside of my little Baylor bubble and suburban upbringing. So I went on one of the first Baylor in Africa studies. And I studied world religion and African literature for the summer and loved it. My eyes were just, I fell in love with Kenya. This was in Kenya specifically. Just to fast forward, I think I've been to Kenya over 30 times now since the 90s. So to say that I fell in love is an understatement, but I have lifelong friendships in Kenya and have many, many like stories. And I never grow tired of returning to Kenya, seeing the people, seeing the beauty of the land, of the animals. And I actually lead some of my craft and culture tours there still today. The other experience was the day after I graduated from Baylor, I decided to go to India. And that was, again, through Mission Waco. They offered some cross-cultural experiences to really engage with what's going on in the world, specifically among the Global South and where there are people that don't have as much access as people in the Global North do. And really, it was to
to rock my world, to say the least. The first place we showed up in was Calcutta. One of the first things we did was started volunteering with Mother Teresa. So this is when she was still alive. And then we went just for, you know, several weeks through, it was like a month, I think, several weeks. We toured around and just learned from a lot of different organizations that were doing things. And then everybody left. My one friend, Brooke, and I stayed. This is pre-cell phone, pre-internet. I didn't even have like credit cards. We just like all of a sudden found ourselves in Delhi, India by ourselves. And we're like, what are we supposed to do? And so we just called this one family from a business card that was doing like outreach in Calcutta and felt like there was more for us to learn. And so we called and said, hi, we met you when our group came through and we would love to come back and volunteer and learn more. And this Indian family showed so much hospitality. They just said, yes, come. When will you be here? And we booked a flight and told them when we'd be there. And they basically hosted us the whole rest of the summer and let us just be a part of anything we wanted to be a part of. So we helped out with their schools, their programs, and we continued to volunteer with Mother Teresa's work. So that really changed me, to say the least. When I came back from those 2 years of experiences, I also lived over in the former Soviet Union for almost a year, doing a cross-cultural exchange. And this, all these things I told you were in 2 years. That's a lot, right?
It's phenomenal.
So I'm a big believer in the power that travel can have when you go not just as a tourist, but right. you go as someone with an open heart and an open mind to learn and connect with
open agenda.
Yeah. Just go and to be present and to partner and learn. So where I am today is really building on those early experiences from my 20s. We are now back in Waco as of the last 2 months, which feels so ironic. Like that was where my life changed. And now that we're back here in another, in a college town, and my husband will be teaching film at this college, is really kind of to be determined what that means for artists and nomad and where, but I know it's an influential time in a lot of people's lives. And kind of where that led was over the course of the almost 30 years that Brandon and I have been married. I fell in love with Brandon, by the way, on that trip back from Calcutta, from volunteering for the Teresa. I was passing through Dallas and Brandon was on his way to NYU film. And I was like, hey, listen, he was at a wedding in Dallas. I was like, if you stay, I'm coming back from India. Will you pick me up? Let's catch up before you go to New York. And literally, that's when you could go to the door when you're getting off an airplane. And we fell in love when we saw each other. And it was like, all of a sudden, my best friend's a hottie. We had no idea. Like, we don't know what happened. We were just really good friends in Baylor. I even set him up with my roommates in college and my sorority sisters and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, I was like, wait, why haven't we dated? And we, long story short, we got married a few months later. So we've been married almost 30 years now, but we were very good friends. And our whole marriage has been kind of a dance around humanitarian outreach and humanitarian work, as well as the creative arts.
Very good.
It's just so amazing. Long friendships, long marriage. That's so beautiful.
It is. We still have fun. And we've done so. We're kind of each other's cheerleaders. Brandon and I, he's always supported me when I had the crazy idea of starting an ethical fashion company that was born out of doing volunteer work back in India again and Kenya. And I saw those trends of empowering women. And a lot of NGOs wanted to have women use design, you know, like make jewelry or, you know, block print or something like that. And they were training them in skills or utilizing traditional skills they had, but really they had no design input or marketplace. And so after seeing this happening, this was like in the early 2000s, I realized I'm in LA where Brandon was a filmmaker. I have all these friends in design. I'm at creative at heart and often was an art director for Brandon's film and things like that in our early marriage. And I thought, why don't we just partner with these NGOs to help support what they're doing to help them design collections and open up that marketplace. And that ended up turning into Raven and Lily, which was one of the first ethical fashion companies here in the States.
Well, I guess we now need to turn it over to Brandon and let him a chance to give us his origin story, because we've taken it up to the time that you've met and everything. So Brandon, tell us all about your origins, or how you got from where you were to where you are now.
All right. I grew up in Orange County, Southern California. And 8 years old, I went and saw the film The Champ. Do you know the Ricky Schroeder, John Voight film, right? The Champ? So yes. I'm a little young to see an emo boxing movie, but it wrecked me and it made me cry. at 8 years old. I remember the Brea Plaza Theater, very distinct memory. And then 2 weeks later, went back. I had gone with my aunt to see the film. And this, I went back with my parents. Same film, same theater, made me cry again. And I thought, what is this magic? How can you know everything that's going to happen and see it again? And it still gives you this emotional response. And so I asked my dad, you know, what is this magic? He explained to me how films were made. And I declared it at 8 years old that while all my friends wanted to play for the Dodgers or be firemen or astronauts, I wanted to be a filmmaker. And so it was a very young pursuit that I haven't given up on since I was 8 years old. And that turned into like a VHS camera and then a Super 8 camera, graduating from middle school and high school. So I'm one of those, you know, I don't know if cliche is the right word, but the guy that was, you know, making everyone in his neighborhood be in his films and shooting Super 8, shooting VHS, and knew that that's what I wanted to do. I ended up at Baylor University because of storytelling. I wanted to focus on English. And actually, you know, coming from Southern California to Central Texas was an odd route. I actually ended up there by way of Aspen. I was a ski bum between my second half of my freshman year, and everyone that I met in Aspen had graduated from Baylor. Some family had gone to Baylor, so I knew about the university and ended up there for studying English. And it's interesting because Kirsten and I met early on at Baylor, and it's interesting because she talks about that story very different. I was kind of this surfer kid from Southern California, and she was what you call a bowhead, if it's okay to say that, sweetie. But it's true that I have pictures to show it. Like, you wear a big bow and you have a lot of hair. So, and I also look
really 90s hair.
Yeah. I also look like Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at the time. So it was kind of like we were very different. So we had both changed. We'd both gone on a big journey since that time. And then I moved. I started working after I graduated. Started working for a label, a 5 Minute Walk Records in the Bay Area, and just started doing music videos, which I loved. And that's how my sort of film career started. You heard the part about the airport and us falling in love. I was going to NYU for an intensive film program because I was bluffing my way through music videos. And then right when we got married, I started Spiral Films. We were married in the Bay Area. And I started my film company, which was basically music videos. And then that turned into commercials. And commercials, I had a really fortunate thing that happened where the first commercial that I did won a Gold Lion at Cannes, which was crazy. And so that was a good way to start a career. That really was just out of the blue. I did a pro bono commercial and it won this really prestigious award. And so my career took off to the point at which we had to move. I was always in LA. And so that moved us from the Bay Area to LA. And that season was where Raymond Lilly started, and a great time of community surrounding us and friends, and doing commercials, music videos, a lot for Disney. I ended up doing a lot of kind of teeny bopper work for Disney, all the kind of Disney stars of the time. And then Kirsten's mom got sick with cancer, and that moved us to Waco, interesting enough, abruptly, like 10 days. We moved in 10 days from LA to Waco, and that season was very tender, and we're there with our kids. We have two wonderful kiddos, and in that season, you know, everyone thought that was career suicide, good for family, but career suicide, to move to, you know, Waco, pre-fixer-upper Waco. But out of that, my first feature film came about, called Saronia. So a real blessing out of a heavy time. And it was beautiful caring for her and in that season. And then that sparked my transition from commercials and music videos to feature films. And then we stuck in Texas. Texas has been really good to me as a Californian, because I did back-to-back-to-back feature films. So I did a film here called Saronia, and then followed that up with Victor. Then I did a war documentary called A Single Frame. And then, as one does, goes from war documentary to romantic comedy. So I'm all over the map. Yeah, in there we owned a glamping retreat and did a film on the glamping retreat that we had. So we've been on adventure. We, as our kids went to college, we moved to Portugal, kind of took empty nesting to the next level, just got rid of the nest and we're just empty and just went overseas. And then I love teaching. And so that is how it was great to be overseas because of Kirsten's work with Artists and Nomad, you know, the Raven and Lily pivoted in a season. Then of course, COVID happened. She started this amazing regenerative travel company, Artists and Nomad, where she takes people to these amazing places. And with all her relationships and all the artisans, she meets with them and gets the opportunity for people's lives to be changed in relationship with people. And so the way this all comes together is she comes home from one of these trips and everyone's encouraging her, saying, you know, eight of us can't be the only ones to tell this story or to know these beautiful stories. And so, of course, my career, you know, filmmaking, and Kirsten's been there. And like she said, she also used to do art direction and wardrobe and things for me. But she came home and said, I'm doing a documentary. And I said, that's incredible. Let's do it. And so that's how these sort of things all came together. And we were then in London. I was teaching at the London Screen Academy, which I loved. And so based out of London, the thing too, to get into this maybe goes off topic of the journey, but just her as a director, if I can brag, she was just incredible because it's almost like that, you know, the Karate Kid, wax on, wax off, paint the fence. You know, she'd been doing this, all these things and been around film and then all of this advocacy work. And then when she jumped into the director's seat on this documentary, it's like all these things kind of, she knew how to do it. She's an incredible director. So it was incredible for me to just come alongside as a producer with her and then cinematographer. And so that's how that film came about. And so here, Brandon, we are.
So Brandon, with being involved with, how involved were you with Raven and Lily?
Yeah, I think I was just number one fan and cheerleader. It was my official role. You know, I was, that happened in a time where I was full on in the music video and commercial world.
You were on the board of directors early on as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So I had the official role early on. And of course we do everything together. Like we're, you know, in the same way that Kirsten would be giving me input. Yeah, Kirsten would be giving me input on my Jonas Brothers video. I would be giving her input on the latest, you know, design thing. So we very much work together in that way.
I also, Brandon also did the photography for a lot of my early lookbooks and collections and all of that, which was super fun to do together.
And Brandon, I just have to ask, are you a Canon or Nikon shooter?
Canon.
Oh, I knew I loved you from a start. So,
yeah.
Because friends don't let friends shoot with Nikon. So,
that's true. You're going to get, I want to, your comments just blew up.
No.
But no, I'm firmly in the Canon camp.
It's really how you start. You know, like I started with the old AE-1, and, you know, you're used to that. And then you move up with the Lin series. I skipped the entire film EOS.
You're looking at his photos behind you.
Oh, there you go.
That's shot at Yosemite on a Canon AE-1.
Oh, there right you there. Go. Yeah. But, you know, I went through it A1, and my final film camera was the T90, which people don't really know, but the Japanese call it the tank, and it's built solid and everything. But I skipped the entire film EOS era because I had so much lens investment in the lens, the FD lenses. So long story short, I finally jumped in when the Canon 5D, the first affordable full a frame came about and, you know, went from there. So,
yeah, I still shoot the AE-1 to this day. I still shoot that Canon AE-1 all the time. I love it.
Well, before we move on to the work, I was going to ask you about, did you ever work in actual filmmaking, working with film at all? Or did you always stay in the video realm?
Oh, you're Kirsten smiling because she knows that's my favorite question. I was the guy that stuck with analog. And in fact, it really boosted my career in the sense that everyone switched to digital and I remained a purist. And as a result, my career actually jumped, and it was because people started saying how great my work was, but actually I just stayed the course. And while everyone else was kind of early adopters of digital, I just kept shooting film. And so I was the last holdout to shoot digital. And on my feature films, my first film, Saronia, I shot on 35 millimeter film.
Right.
And it wasn't until my second feature film, Victor, that just from a budget standpoint, I was forced to shoot digital. And unfortunately, it looked awesome. So I was like, oh no, you know, because I really loved falling on that sword. And my students will tell you, you know, I'm such an analog film guy. So yeah, I still love film.
Do you still have your Super 8s?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
I wish I did. I loved Super 8.
So great.
It has a 16 millimeter camera.
Yeah. I still have the CP16 camera that I shot all my early music videos on. I still have it.
Well, you're listening to our guests today, Kirsten and Brandon Dinkerson on Art in the Air. And we'll be back after just a brief pause to talk about their story and their filmmaking life together. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. And you're listening to Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. With our guests today, Kirsten and Brandon Dickerson.
So Artist and Nomad. So when did that name happen? And was it named first? And how did it all come together? Because it's such a fascinating blend of activity.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's so funny because I thought of after I resigned from being the CEO of Raven & Lily for 10 years, I had thought of starting Artisan Nomad in 2019. And at that time, we were living in a German village in Texas called Fredericksburg. And I really loved the name. But then I came across this word, Fernwe, which means a longing to travel and aching to see the world in German. And I thought, you know what? I should call it the Fernwe Studio if I'm going to do a travel company being based in this German town, because that says everything. Well, that company didn't last very long. It was only like a year and a half old when COVID hit. And so I came back from a tour on like March 14th from Oaxaca, Mexico, and March 15th, 2020 is when everything shut down. And then all of the rest of the tours I had booked and prepaid that year, I didn't really get refunded on. Mm. And I refunded all the people that had signed up and sent deposits. Mm. So long story short, I had to just like officially close it because I didn't know, you know, how when it kept going on for months, I was like, I'm not going to recover from this. But that name was still kind of like a name, Artisan Nomad, that I had thought of back then. And it was during COVID that I got tagged to be the president of Tirza International, which is a global women's empowerment organization that works alongside indigenous women leaders that are advocates fighting injustice against women in their context. And I was tagged to help them relaunch, rebrand, identify new leaders around the world, develop an emerging leader program, and start micro enterprise, and also work with social business. So sounds like a lot. It was a 3-year job to like launch. I'm good at starting things is what I've realized. So I actually loved the challenge. And some of my favorite, I mean, I loved working with these women. It was like in 35 countries and like translating like in 9 languages. Some of this curriculum and these things we were developing was very challenging, but also exciting because you were just putting it into the hands of these leaders that could develop it in their context and have these resources to do amazing things in their countries for women. And one of the things I loved the most was the social business part. And that was where during COVID, I did like 3 or 4 different projects, but one of them was renovating a retreat center in Nairobi that would be a social business. And it was during COVID. And so I took on the challenge of basically trying to decorate the whole thing, only working alongside artists and artisans in Kenya. And the reason I wanted to do that is because none of them were employed at the time. They couldn't do anything. And so it was kind of a way to give employment to people that were really not able to do much during the major lockdown. And I met some incredible artisans in Kenya through that. And then as a result, I wanted to know once COVID restrictions were lifted, how I could support these incredible artisan leaders and what they were doing. And that's eventually, after my job finished with Tirza, where I got the idea for Artisan Nomad, is I wanted to know how could I continue to walk with some of these incredible artisan leaders that I've met through artists and through Raven & Lily, as well as Tirza. How do I pass on a lot of the knowledge and the connections that I have so that these incredible women would be able to have direct market access to sell their goods and to grow their business. And so part of what Artisan Nomad did was born out of those relationships of walking, mm-hmm. continuing partnering with these incredible leaders. And for example, one of them named Isabel is in the documentary, and we've been partnering together for several years. She's a leader in Kenya that runs a workshop that supports multiple different artisans in Kenya that have no market access. And she's done really well in Kenya. But what's unusual about her that we talk about in the documentary is that almost every successful brand within Kenya, and especially internationally, is owned by an expat or a Westerner in Europe or America or Australia. There's hardly anything successful owned by a Kenyan, much less a Kenyan woman. So it became our challenge to figure out how to help her go from that point A to B. And so she actually was able to bring her first collection to Shop Object in New York last February. And that was after 2 years of walking together through Artisan Nomad mentorship behind the scenes. And so that's part of what Artisan Nomad started initially. And then the other part of it was these craft and culture tours where I could be like, I want other people to meet these incredible artisans and nonprofits that I've gotten to know over the years. And the reason we call it Artisan Nomads, because Brandon and I have been nomadic, as you've heard, we've moved around a lot. Yeah. And a lot of the cultures where I've worked are still nomadic cultures, and especially Northern Africa, at least in their heritage they were. And then artists, I think we're different artists in different way. And so it just sort of captured like the people we were working with, who we were, all the places we were traveling. And then the tours invite people to just come with me on an insider journey, partner with all these incredible people I know locally. You take artisan workshops, you visit these incredible NGOs or nonprofits, and we learn from locals about the history and the culture. And I think a lot of the women that travel would be sometimes women that maybe have never gone on a tour like that, but they feel safe to go with me because it's also elevated. I am a big fan of beauty. And I want people to see the beauty that all these cultures have, and that in a very authentic way. That's what people love to travel. But there's so much exploitation now with travel because of social media and all of that, that people go to the same things and it's just becomes tourism. And so I wanted to go deeper. And that's where that comes transformative, and kind of where Brandon was mentioning, people were like, how can more people experience this and see, especially with artisans, like, how amazing it is to support arts and craft, and why it's so valuable, and why it should cost a little bit more, but how, what a difference it makes in the lives of people holding on to their heritage and their family's provision. And that's where I thought, you know, you can't write a book about this. I don't actually want to grow a bigger company that's just doing tours, but maybe I do a documentary. So that was kind of where I couldn't sleep one night coming the end of a Morocco tour, because they kept pushing me. Like, what? Kirsten, something, you've got to do something. And that was where the idea was born.
So Kirsten, while you said you didn't grow up in poverty, were your parents involved with social issues? Is that why, do you think that was like resonant at all? No, not
honestly,
at all.
Honestly, they weren't at all. I mean, I really was in a privileged suburban community. It actually gives me a lot of patience and compassion, recognizing that if you are from that community, you really don't understand what's going on in the world sometimes and what you're reading in the news. And especially if you get certain slants on what's happening, because your world is so insular and you're around so many people that are like you. And so that's why I enjoy inviting people to come with me. I really am very different than the majority of the people that I grew up with and I went to college with, but they're still my friends. And so I have this interesting life of being friends with people that, you know, are on the margins, and they're dear friends, people that are in these communities making a difference in their friends, and then people that are very much outside of that and doing really well in life and but don't have a lot of these worries that a lot of the people in the world have, but have influence. They have money and they have hearts. And I know that if I can invite them into these experiences, they're good at their core, and their hearts will open up and they'll want to engage and make a difference. And that's kind of what I'm doing.
So have any of your Baylor friends gone on any of the trips with you?
Yes, they have. You know, it's been interesting. Early on when Brandon and I, we started Artisan Nomad together when we were in Portugal. And it was so fun when we did our first retreats in Portugal and then tours to see people from, would you say Brandon, high school? Go back to high school, wanting to like all of a sudden come visit us, come join these things. It's been a great way with our nomadic life to have people from every chapter come back through. So we have been able to stay in touch with a lot of people through Artisan Nomad who have joined the tours from high school, Baylor, LA, Austin, Fredericksburg, everywhere we've lived, to be honest.
You know, that brings me back to your time in Portugal when you were empty nesters, so to speak. Tell us about that experience. I had some good friends of ours who were from Northwest Indiana, and they decided to go to Portugal and live and everything. But, you know, tell us about the experience. I mean, that's I don't assume either one of you speak Portuguese or everything like that, or learn it or everything. But yeah, tell us about that experience of being in Portugal.
You would assume after 3 years, one of us would speak Portuguese well, and only Kirsten. I really struggled with the language. I love the culture. For us, we had that when Kirsten became the CEO of Tirza and was traveling so much. And I had a commissioned screenplay. Kids were going off to school. And so I could write anywhere. And then I also wanted to teach more. So I was going to get a master's. So all of these things, we had a checklist of get on that side of the pond so we can be closer to Kirsten's travel. Needs to be less expensive than the States. Needs to be immigrant friendly, that you can come in, you know, and be a place where you're welcomed. And then Kirsten would make sure that I note, and it is very true, that it needed to be near the ocean, because I had the Californian that had been landlocked for a decade in Texas was eager to get back to the ocean. So if those are your criteria,
the surfer, pretty much that wasn't clear. He loves surfing.
I do love surfing. And there's surfing in Waco, by the way, at Waco Surf, to be noted. So the criteria was just Portugal. So we moved there. I had never been. We moved to Portugal and I had never been to Portugal. And we fell in love with the culture, with the people. It was great. I think, you know, we get asked a lot about people wanting to move. And I think that there are, from my opinion, kind of right reasons and wrong reasons. And in the idea of kind of coming and integrating, being a part of the community. In fact, the one thing that I wish I had done much more is spent more time with language, because you can really engage on a soul level when you can do better than a second grade level speaking. Mm-hmm. So those that were engaging that way, I think, are having a fantastic experience. Those that are just wanting to kind of create a bubble within it for all the culture and great medical resources and that, I think, it's less spectacular. And you're starting to see a little bit. I mean, it rose like 500% people coming from out of from America. So it's a mixed thing, but we lived on this island called the Azores.
Oh yeah.
Which was just, oh my gosh, it was incredible. The people there, it was a dream. Yeah. Volcanoes and surfing and the local culture and the people that we met. And so that was really beautiful, but we love Portugal. It was awesome.
We actually lived in three places. We lived in Lisbon, then the Azores Islands, and then on a farm, a vineyard in the Vinho Verde green wine region. And had three different experiences. So it was really interesting. We kind of had that freedom to try out a lot of different things. And so that's what we did.
Isn't Portugal big wave surfing?
Yeah, I did not do that. Let's be clear. I did not. I went and watched them surf at Nazaré. Wow. But I did not, which was incredible to see. But I by no means surfed there.
You're listening to our guests today, Kirsten and Brandon Dickerson, on Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Yeah, watching surfing is one of my guilty pleasures. So
being the Hawaii girl that you are, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask Brandon about filmmaking. You've got enough of a career that you've seen so many things happen. And tell us about changes you like. I mean, obviously, we talked about film versus video, but tell us about how filmmaking, in your perspective, has developed, changed, better or worse.
Yeah, it's the wild, wild west right now, right? On so many levels. For me, it's all about story. I mean, it's why I got an English degree. It's all about story, story, story. And then I'm less interested in kind of new technologies, but I follow them. And as a teacher, you know, as a prof, obviously I need to be at the forefront of understanding what's going on. And just recently, like the idea of the growing micro drama, I'll be honest, that is really difficult for me on two levels. One is that it's micro dramas are, I just learned about this recently, and I'm sure I'm behind the curve, but it's the idea of a vertical story, which I have a real problem with. Like, let's be honest, just the idea of, and if you don't know horizontal, like if you turn your phone landscape mode, that's cinema to me. That's been cinema. That's always the, you want to go back and do a square, I'm fine with that. But you turn that sideways, the way that we all hold our phones, and people are realizing that we watch short bits on our phones. And so there's a move in the industry, so to speak, the filmmaking industry, of let's make short pieces of content in a vertical format. I am troubled by this. I am really troubled by this because I think we're losing our ability to be present, to just dwell in the moment, to slow down. I mean, this is where you see Kirsten and I really come together on, you know, more contemplative, more thoughtful ideas. The idea of going on a trip, and these trips that Kirsten leads are not fast, fast, fast. They're slow and you pause. And that's my feeling towards cinema. No surprise. I love the being in a theater, sitting down, watching it all unfold. But I'm mindful that there, and it's interesting with my students, you know, I'm thinking about how to talk to them about making a living in this new landscape. Whereas the films, but probably my first film, or even my films that sort of went indie films and festivals, and a few of them end up on Netflix, that world really isn't quite there anymore. So I need to be mindful of where things are. But I like slow, I like thoughtful, I like analog. And so in the same way, Esther, you're talking about the technology before we jumped on, I'm challenged by it, and I'm trying to find bridges. I'm trying to find ways to get future filmmakers to think of where we've been and where we are. And I don't know if I'm going to be the guy that's saying, let's flip our phone sideways and tell stories in 90 seconds.
Right. Well, you know, the BBC actually did the news format. They were presenting news in a vertical format. And So there's that tall tendency. And, you know, you talk about micro dramas, and sometimes you can see them like in, like there's these like little 2 or 3 minute things where almost like a little soap opera thing that happens like about 3 minutes. And, you know, there's a lot of times online, and it's like, yeah, so it's going to be a tough road to hold. And, you know, the other thing, I did a theater career, and my students, I'd always talk to them about show business and how it's really a business and how tough it is. I says, you know, you just don't go through that, get a theater degree, and instant you got a job. And so, yeah, it must be the same thing.
It's true.
Filmmaking.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of, I literally start every class by saying there's too much business in show business. And, but you need to know that.
Right.
Like, if you want to survive and thrive, you've got to be mindful of the realities of that. And we want to make livings and tell meaningful and impactful stories. And we're not, also want to say, we're all susceptible to this, right? I mean, I say this as this sort of, you know, the cinema guy, and then we're going to turn off this thing and I'm going to start looking at some 90 second thing on my phone. You know, it's like, I understand the addictive nature of it. So I think we have to be intentional about slowing down, because the algorithm's after us. So
Kirsten, so when you're in Kenya, how did you choose weavers? There are so many different crafts. So I'm kind of interested in, with all these countries, how you gravitated towards certain crafts.
Well, when I came back from that Morocco trip specifically, it's interesting just to tag off of what Brandon said to answer your question, because my background was also in business. I've had to give a lot of pitches when I had that ethical fashion company to raise a lot of money for it. So I came home and just said, what do I need to put in a film pitch pack? And so Brandon just sent me an example, but it was like within a few days, I was like, how's this? I put together a pitch packet and I was like ready to raise the money for this film. I was just like, I've got a vision for it. I'm ready to make it happen. So this, mind you, is November. So all I did was just sit on who am I supposed to ask? And I just really, you know, thought about it and prayed about it. And there were about five or six people that were really strong in my mind. So that's all I started with, was to send a pitch packet to those and did sort of the process I would have done when I was like raising money and doing different series of raises when I had a for-profit business, was like applying it to documentary. And this is a nonprofit documentary, but again, nonprofits are also businesses. So I've like learned you have to run everything well. And you know, what's interesting for you to know is that all the people, I would say 90% of the people that have donated to the nonprofit to fund this film have traveled with me. And so this film is because they all understood what I was going to say. Yeah. And when I thought about that pitch packet, I had to think of like, who would I feature in this film? Because I know so many artisans all over the world. I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of every sector. I always tell people, if you want to source something ethically and artisan made, you could just name the category and I can help you find that person, because I've had those kinds of connections, or people that are like peers in the space that could help make those connections. Right. And so I really wanted it to be not an expensive film. And so, you know, Brandon and I doing it together as a nonprofit could offer a lot of our skills and experiences to the film. And then we did an equity model. And then I looked at where was I traveling that next year. And so a lot of that narrowed in what artisan groups I would do. And a lot of my tours are in Portugal, Morocco, India, Kenya. I was living in England and I'm from the US. And I had a tour this summer in Oaxaca. So basically, those were all the places that I thought of, like where I was going to be doing tours that next couple of years, where I could go early, stay longer, or go back a couple of times connecting to tours. And then I looked at, there's multiple people I know in the artisan sector in each of those countries. So then I just looked at the variety of stories and examples, both of craft, as well as when it's a family versus a larger cooperative, as well as fair trade models, direct trade models. I looked at all of the different things and then tried to put together 6 countries with 9 different artisan stories to follow, just to give you a glimpse of the nuances within the global handmade artisan sector. So that's kind of how I did that.
Yeah. And so weavers are so visually interesting too.
You know, I'm a weaver. I mean, that's where I started. My discipline is weaving and textiles. And so,
I didn't see the weaving specifically. I'm a textile junkie. So of course, but that was actually a problem, is because I know way too many weavers, but I had to like balance it with those things. So you have like the Moroccan rug weavers, and then you have the cotton loom weavers, and then you have the Kenyan basket weavers, and then you have the Oaxaca backstrap weavers. I snuck it in a lot.
Well, we're close to the end here, but I wanted to ask this question real quick of both of you. Now, I know you're settling into a new gig there in Waco, but is there something that you'd like to do that you haven't done yet?
Ooh, what a great question. You know, Kirsten and Baylor actually reminded me that I'm a producer. And I really hadn't thought of, I've always thought of myself as writer director, but I've been producing all along, and really took that up when Kirsten had this idea. I'm like, man, I'm going to produce this. And then Baylor specifically was looking for somebody to talk more about producing. And then this position here is both filmmaking and teaching. And so I guess I've done it a bit, but I'm really leaning into, like, I just met yesterday these filmmakers that I love, doing this documentary called The Storms We Carry, about a storm chaser that sort of realized that the storms in his own life are bigger than the storms outside and went through a breakdown. And so I'm now kind of, as well as I'm sure continue to direct and definitely write, but I'm leaning into producing a lot more. So I think that would be it for me.
Ironically, I think I got the filmmaking bug. So I have about the next film that I want to direct. Maybe Brandon will produce. And then I would love to potentially, now that we're rooted in Waco, open up a store, an artisan store that supports all these incredible makers. We have little pop-ups when we travel to show the film, which is basically the next 6 months, doing film festivals and special engagements. So the film will be shown at the International Folk Art Market in Santa Fe. The film will be shown at Shop Object, which is the huge like wholesale retail market in New York. It'll be shown on August 2nd at Shop Object. It's going to be shown at the London Textile Week with Selvage Magazine September 12th in London. And several other places. So it's been really fun to like just figure out in Chicago, actually, it's going to be this will probably air afterwards, but we're screening it at the Fair Trade Museum in Chicago at the end of this month on May 28th. So we're really excited to partner with people that are enthusiastic about this film and can share with audiences that care. And I'm doing little pop-up markets at some of the places to sell crafts to support the artisans in the film. And that's been such a positive experience for people watching the film and for the artisans that it's made me want to maybe open a store. So that'll be my like thing I'm mulling over for Waco next year.
Website where people can find you guys?
artistandnomad.com, and Instagram also is artist.and.nomad.
Great. And we'll have a link on our your picture on our website. Kirsten and Brandon Dickerson, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Year. Handmade Future is the film you can watch. Go to the website and find out probably locations it will air. Thank you very much for sharing your whole journey and everything together. It's been very fascinating.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, complete pleasure. I saw the trailer. It's so gorgeous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art of the Year, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.